So weather patterns, we're going to talk about weather patterns a little bit, because as you know, it's a big part in the scriptures. Up to this point, you guys hear me okay? Is this loud enough? What's the primary reason we've talked about where God would bless Israel or punish Israel? What's the main thing we've talked about so far through a lot of the scriptures, a lot of the pictures? Being the land bridge, being in an area where all their enemies wanted their land.
Peace,
victory, if they were obedient. And what if they were disobedient? The threat was removal, exile. And that did happen. We know Israel in 722 B.C. and in 586. They were exiled from the land, taken out of the land. But there's another thing that God talks about quite a bit in the scriptures, as far as if they're obedient or if they obey or if they disobey. God used the weather to punish them or to bless them. Psalm 135:7 says, "He it is who makes the clouds rise at the end of the earth, who makes lightnings for the rain and brings forth the wind from his storehouses." So we all know this. God's in charge of weather. I don't know that we live like that necessarily. We live in a country in a time when if it doesn't rain, we still have water. Maybe our grass gets a little brown, but we still have all the fruits and vegetables, all the food we need. It's not really a big deal here in this country. But that's not the case in Israel. Just looking a little bit at the terrain, Israel is kind of trapped, if you will, or in a struggle between the desert out here, the Arabian Desert, and the Mediterranean Sea. Now, there's a lot of other factors that play in it. Jet stream, the highs, the lows, summer and the winter. I'm not going to go into what causes all these things, but basically starting in the summer, you have a very stable air. You're not getting any storms. Storms is a rarity. And that's why in scripture in 1 Samuel, they make a comment about, well, God will bring a storm in the summer. And it's not the normal thing. What we have in the summer is a very stable air, very hot, very dry, and you have moisture that comes in off of the Mediterranean Sea, and that's what gives the country the dew in the morning. And the dew is often what gets the crops through that hot, deserty summer. Then moving into the fall, this is the time of the early rains. If you hear that term in the scripture, earlier rains, latter rains, and this will again come in primarily from the Mediterranean, the moisture, and if God would provide it, they would have rain which would soften the ground so that they could plant, so that they could plow and get the primarily the wheat and the barley in the fields. They could also start harvesting in the fall the olives and other some of the nut trees and fruit trees, and then occasionally in the fall they would have a warm, hot east wind. And many scriptures referring to the east wind. And this would be just a hot wind. And if you remember that Israel is right in the middle of the Mediterranean and Arabian Desert, when you think of that east wind, it's just going to be a hot, lowers the temperature like 40 degrees, basically removes the humidity from the air, and it can be a very difficult time. So the fall is very unpredictable. It's not a stable time. Moving into the winter, it's a little bit more stable, or at least predictable. You get the things off of the Mediterranean. You get several storms, maybe 25 storms a season, and this is where they provide the heavy rains for Israel, and this is what they need for the crops to flourish in the spring. Springtime, then, again, it's an unpredictable time. You can have the winds off of the desert coming in at times, but now you have from the heavy winter winds, you have all kinds. You have the flowering of the pasture lands. You have the trees starting to bloom. And it's very, very pretty until the end of spring when summer comes, and then the heat and things dry up, and it goes from just beautiful colors and then it becomes kind of brown and gray. Other than Karen, you can't answer this question, Karen Oweiler, but what climate does this kind of remind you of that we're more familiar with? And don't say Illinois, because that's not the right answer.
California?
Southern California. It's very, very similar, which is kind of interesting because a lot of the kids from Master's College are from California, Southern California, and the rest of them live there for several years as they went to school. And you have the mountains, and you have the coast, and you have the desert, so you have it all. And a very similar long planting season, just like in California. You have crops almost all year round. Okay, east winds. So just kind of, yeah.
Now you have that map.
Yep. That's the Rift Valley, and that's...
No, not that one, the one going to the coast, going to the Mediterranean.
Oh, this? Okay, that's the Jezreel Valley right in here.
Jezreel.
Yep, and that is a very rich farmland, always has been. And it goes all the way up and kind of connects with the Asher, the Plain of Asher, or Plain of Akko, different names. We talked about these earlier, but yeah, that's... That is a very productive area. They get lots of rain. Mount Carmel right here. And this is Megiddo is right here. So that's where, you know, we talk about Armageddon, and this is this huge area about, I think it's 20 miles by 20 by 20, something like that, where the troops will gather. Now, I don't know that the millions that they talk about in the scripture will all fit in that spot, but they said there will be a lot of them there. So... Oopsie. So just real quick, and this kind of makes sense, is what we talked about. You're going to get most rain up in the high elevations, and then along the coast, along the Med, more rain. And then as the east winds come, they come up the mountains, and you get a little bit more rain over here. Of course, this is modern-day Jordan. So the rainfall, more in the north and more in the west, kind of makes sense. Now, I'm going to pick on Karen here again. This is a picture that, if I recall, you were in Israel when they had one of the largest snowfalls in Jerusalem in a long time, right? Well, how many inches did you guys have?
I don't remember.
It was significant. It was for Jerusalem or for... Right. Or you get just a dusting... But this, when Karen was there, and I don't know if this picture is from that year or not, but when Karen was there, I know it was like, wow, you know, biggest snow in years in Jerusalem.
We were walking through Jerusalem that day.
Hmm. Ah. With sandals in the snow in Jerusalem. College kids. Come on.
What's the elevation?
Around 2,500 feet. And that's what's really interesting, this whole country, sea level. 2,500 feet, where'd Jerusalem go? Right here. Jericho, 1,000 feet below sea level. The Dead Sea, 1,300 to 1,400 feet below sea level. So in this tiny little area, you have a huge change in topography. Okay. Importance of rain. There's no major rivers in Jordan River, as we saw, more like the Sangam, is not a major river. There's no Nile like in Egypt. There's no Tigris or Euphrates. So even though they're that fertile crescent, they don't have the rivers like the other countries do. For the land into which you are entering to possess it is not like the land of Egypt from which you came, where you used to sow your seed and water it with your foot or irrigate like a vegetable garden. So Israel is very, very dependent on rain. And this was as they obeyed, they got the rain. As they disobeyed, they didn't. Mike?
Today, do they have irrigation?
Pardon?
Do they have irrigation today?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a totally different deal.
So they're getting it out of the ground?
They're getting it from wherever they can. Galilee, the Sea of Galilee is huge. The Jordan River, they use a lot of that. But they have now they have modern techniques to move it and use it, whereas they didn't really so much back then.
There's no groundwater you would
I don't know. I mean, the wells are very scarce in Israel. That's why they have so many cisterns. So the groundwater is not prevalent. Working on desalination so that they can take the water from the Med and use it. But that's still a process, in process. So, but the land into which you are about to cross to possess it, a land of hills and valleys, drinks water from the rain of the heavens. So, you know, they are dependent on the rain. And rain is contingent upon their obedience, rain in the spiritual state of the nation. Beware lest your hearts be deceived and you turn away and serve other gods and worship them, or the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you and he will shut up the heavens so that there will be no rain and the ground will not yield its fruit, and you will perish quickly from the good land which the Lord is giving you. You can see that's Deuteronomy and also in Leviticus. And I will also break down your pride of power. I will also make your sky like iron and your earth like bronze. So the Lord threatening, promising, however you want to look at it, that Israel is disobedient. That's what they'll do. Spiritual drought will result in the physical drought. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments so as to carry them out, then I shall give you rains in their season. And we just talked about that. The early rains, the heavy rains in the winter, and the latter rains. That was very key for Israel's economy. So that the land will yield its produce and the trees of the field will bear their fruit. When the heavens are shut up and there is no rain because they have sinned against thee, and they pray toward this place and confess thy name and turn from their sin when thou dost afflict them. And remember the whole Elijah and the prophets of Baal and Mount Carmel, that once the revival occurred after the all the prophets of Baal were killed, and the Lord granted them the rain after their spiritual revival. And of course, water is just a predominant theme in Scripture in general, certainly in the New Testament, but even talking about the millennial kingdom in Zechariah, and it will come about in that day that living waters will flow out of Jerusalem, half of them toward the Eastern Sea, which we know is the Dead Sea, and the other half toward the Western Sea, which is the Mediterranean Sea. It will be in summer as well as in winter. Remember, typical Israel in the time of the Bible, there was nothing in the summer. It was dry. The riverbeds were all dried up. They had the Jordan and the dew. So, but now the Lord's promising in the summer as well as the winter. And the Lord will be king over all the earth. In that day, the Lord will be the only one, and his name the only one. He who believes in me, as the scripture said, from his innermost being shall flow rivers of living water. And of course, we're not talking about literal water, but Christ talking about him being within us. The rain cycle in Israel. Okay. Again, Deuteronomy, that he will give the rain for you, for your land in its season, the early and the late rain, that you may gather in your grain, your new wine, and your oil. So Israel's in the Middle East. What kind of oil are we talking about?
Olive
oil. Very good. Again, if you don't have any background and you think Middle East, you might think, oh, they're getting the oil out of the ground. Well, now that wasn't really developed back then, but it's olive oil. Olive oil was huge for Israel, and an interesting point is that Egypt didn't have the climate or the ground to produce olives in any great way, either to Mesopotamia. So the Philistines, that coast where the Philistines are, and Israel, that was huge for olives. And so they had a really very good product and an exporting product and a source of income because of their huge olives. Again, early rains are October, November, winter rains, December through February, latter rains, May and April. Okay, sources of water. Of course, rainfall. This is on the Mount, or on the Temple Mount, near the Dome of the Rock, and some ibexers getting rained on. Cisterns. Remember, what's the difference between a cistern and a well?
Cistern is dry and it holds rainwater.
Okay. All right. So, and a well is from groundwater. And the cistern is just a storage facility. Well, there weren't really very many wells in Israel, and there still aren't. There's just not a lot of groundwater. And the wells that they did have would kind of also act, they would set it up so it would also capture the rainwater. So you would have the wells and the cisterns all capturing the rainwater when they could get it. So that, you know, if you've been around here, you've heard Gary quote Jeremiah 2:12-13, which if you understand how critical the cisterns and the rainwater is to the nation of Israel, when you read Jeremiah 2:12-13, be appalled, O heavens, at this. Be shocked. Be utterly desolate, declares the Lord. For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters. Again, God referring to the water. And hewed out cisterns for themselves, broken cisterns that can hold no water. So very much making a relation to the Israelites as he's speaking, or Jeremiah, actually they're Jews now because it's a post-exilic, but letting them know that, you know, your cisterns are critical for your life, but you're just putting your life in a broken cistern, so the water is just leaking out. The water, the living water of God. Springs, we have several springs that we've talked about. Gihon, which is in the lifeblood of Jerusalem. And Gedi, which is where David hid out in the desert from Saul. And then Herod, another spring that's at the foot of Mount Gilboa, where Gideon took his men to narrow it down to 300. Rivers, we have a few. That's the Jordan just south of Galilee. But again, not a large source. Nothing like the Nile or the Tigris or Euphrates. Wells, there are wells. And the aqueducts. Somebody asked about aqueducts earlier on. This was built by Herod the Great somewhere around, you know, maybe 10 BC in that neighborhood. And he ran water from Mount Carmel down to the town that he built, or the big port in Caesarea. And this was then added to in about 135 AD by the Romans. So if you go there, there's like two aqueducts running together. One from before Christ's time, and one from about 135. Yeah?
Is that all gravity flow?
Yep. And again, Mount Carmel, the mountain, and then the Caesarea is right on the Med, so it's sea level. And I mean, how they engineered, I mean, Herod engineered a port using cement that set underwater. I mean, amazing the kind of technology they had back in those days. I'm sure a lot of people died doing it, a lot of slave labor and everything, but it's amazing the things that they could do. So this was engineered for the water to grow, flow by gravity. Okay, this is up in Nazareth, and whether it's a well or a cistern, I don't remember for sure, but you see here, this is where they would capture the water off of the limestone, the hard limestone that was prevalent in Nazareth, and it would come down into this little pool here, or this little bowl. The crud would basically sink to the bottom, and then the good water would just flow up and go into the cistern.
There's no leaves. I mean, there's no trees with leaves.
Oh, sure. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. But they got some of the stuff out. That was their filtration. All right. Karen, you remember where this is? Green. It's green. I wouldn't remember it either. So. But this is Nablus, which is the hotbed of Palestinian terrorism. But it's where Shechem originally was, and Sychar. So you talk about Jacob's well, the woman of the well, Christ and the woman of the well. This Greek Orthodox church was built over what most archaeologists, most conservative historians, everybody believes, like, this is the most likely, really, this is the spot where Jacob's well was, because there's so few wells, and this is right near Shechem, right in the vicinity, that probably is over the actual Jacob's well of the Bible. Now you have to go into the church to see it now, and I don't know how well it's preserved. Never been down there. I wouldn't go to Nablus. We were up on Mount Gerizim looking down when I took this picture. Yeah. Did you get to go there?
No.
Okay. Okay. And you know what? I know when I was there in 2007, it wasn't done. But then in 2012, it was. So I don't know what the schedule was there. Okay. So now a land flowing with milk and honey. What do you guys picture when you think of a land flowing with milk and honey? When you read that in the scriptures, what are you picturing?
Abundance,
okay. Pardon?
Rivers of milk.
Lots of milk. Well, how do we get the milk?
Cows.
Cows, okay. Cows. Honey, what do you think of as honey?
Bees.
Bee honey, right? So, just like Oliver and you guys, I'm thinking when I first would read this, I pictured dairy cows, honeybees, and Pooh's 100-acre wood, right? That's kind of what you picture. Well, in Exodus 13:5, the Lord said, and when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, and Hivites, and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, you shall keep this service in this month. So the term milk and honey is used more than 20 times in the scriptures. But I think we have a little different idea, or we need to have a little different idea of what it stands for. And these are pictures of date palms, okay, and dates was one of the key things. Still is in Jericho. If you go to Jericho, Jericho Junction, you can buy all kinds of dates. The land of milk is probably the livestock. So cows, you're right on. Cows, goats, lambs, all those livestock produce the milk. And livestock was a huge part of the ancient Israel and culture. And then the honey, I think as we look at some of the lists in scriptures, they're probably not talking about bees' honey here, though we know that there's a honeycomb, you know, the lion and the honey that Samson ate, and we know that bees are very important for pollination for all trees and fruit trees and so forth. But I think what the term is referring to is agriculture in general. And in Deuteronomy it says, in the land of wheat and barley, of vines, of fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive and honey. So now here honey gets thrown in at the end. And again, it could be bees' honey, but some think probably more likely it was a date honey or maybe a grape honey, which an ancient Israelites would make and they could preserve it and they would have it, and that would be their form of honey. Obviously, we know that honey, bees' honey, was also around. But I don't think that would really fit in with the listing here. But we don't know for sure. But that's kind of my take on it. Mike?
Olives grow on a tree.
Yes.
Short tree?
Well, taller than you. And me. Well, we'll have a picture in a little while.
That's okay. I like that.
And this is a picture I actually took in 2012. We were there right before the wheat harvest, so this was the end of May, and this was near the Valley of Elah, where David and Goliath were, and I took some pictures there, and that's really, I actually took some of the wheat, too, and brought it home, you know, on top of it, but... Okay, the seven species I talk about in Scripture, and this is not an exhaustive list. Wheat, barley, you hear that in Scripture a lot. The grapes, grapes is huge. The wine and the grapes. Pomegranates, olives. I have a better picture of the olive tree later. But olives, it's just huge. Olives, they used it for in their cosmetics. They used it for heating, or not for heating, but for lighting in the temple, for lighting in the home. These were for... cooking, the olive oil was just invaluable to the Israelites and to the Jews. It was just very, very important. And again, they kind of had the corner on it. But them and the Philistines had all the olives in the area. And of course, the grains, the barley and the wheat, they would be mainly produced in the wide valleys, the Jezreel Valley, the coastal valleys, a little bit in the Shephelah also, or any wide valleys, the plains, the fruit trees, the vines, the figs, the pomegranates, olive trees, the date trees. These were all in the hills because they could grow just fine. Olives don't need as much irrigation as some. Let's see. So trees provide the main produce in Israel. And many believe that the trees, these trees that we just talked about, are the honey that the scripture speaks of. Okay. Fig trees. It could be fig as well. And then...
Where do you get the oil from the olives?
Oh, they press it out.
Okay.
And it's... now they use heat and they can do it really fast, but they would grind it with a great big millstone. And a donkey might walk around and they'd just make the first mash, and then the first oil to come out would be the virgin oil. It was same virgin, extra virgin, that's the purest, the best. And then they would go through and they would use very slow process, but that's all they had. Now they use heat and they can do it very quickly. But in Israel, there was a kibbutz that we went to where they didn't use the heat. It took a longer process. They used pressure instead to get the olive oil or the oil out of the olive, and it was a better, they claimed, a better. We bought some. I mean, it was good, but you know. that was when Dawn was with me. We got that. And then some date honey. Okay. Okay, though the fig tree should not blossom, there be no fruit in the vines, though the yield of the olives should fail, and the fields produce no food, though the flocks should be cut off from the food, and there be no cattle in the stalls, yet I will exult in the Lord, I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. This is Habakkuk speaking of what happens when Israel loses all these things. Okay, real quickly, this is just a stone that's about 3 inches by 4.5 inches. It was found in the ancient Tel of Gezer, which is southwest of Jerusalem, about 20 miles, I think. It was discovered in 1908. And this is Hebrew, ancient Hebrew. And apparently from about 925 BC, they're dating it at. And what it is, they think it's just a student practicing his writing. And what he's doing is it's like a poem talking about all the different timings and the different harvesting and the different... So you can see that just kind of year-round, Israel had crops. Okay, agricultural cycle and prosperity. Indeed, your threshing will last for you until grape gathering, and grape gathering will last until some sowing time. You will thus eat your food to the full and live securely in your land. So the way Lord has set it up, because of the climate there and the terrain, the topography, they basically have crops all year round, and this is going to, if they're obedient, it's going to take care of them and feed them all the way through. There is a picture of the old-fashioned way. And in Palestine, some still do this. They beat the tree and they gather the olives down here. Southern California, Don's brother had an olive ranch for a while, and they hired people to come in and hand-pick the olives, which is better than having a mechanical shaker, which is what, you know, the big companies do. And you pay them by the bucket, not the hour. So the faster they are, the more buckets they get full, the more they would make. But that's in Southern California. But there's a tree, Mike. See, there's a tree.
That will take care of a tall guy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Lachish. We've got the grapes in Lachish. This was interesting. Grapes were huge back, apparently, even in the time when Sennacherib, who ended up going against Jerusalem in 701, B.C., but Hezekiah held out against them. Well, he had already whooped up on Lachish on the southern, south of Jerusalem, and they were famous for grapes back then. And then there's a thing that they found in what was Assyria is a picture of the Assyrians capturing Lachish, and they had one of the things they had were these big grapevines that they were taking away. So it kind of goes hand in hand there. And then we have grapes in the Shephelah. Grapevines are dormant in the wet winter months. They produce between May and August, and the dew is important for their development. So that summer dew is really important for the grapes to be productive. And as Brian mentioned this morning, a little bit about the bad water, that there was a lot of wine that was produced, and it was used routinely. Was a big thing for Israel, and they produced a lot of it. Yeah.
Are the vines crawling or whatever that is?
What?
A metal frame?
Well, that's just to support the vines.
How tall is that?
Oh, not very, I don't think. Grapes are usually kind of...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I think it's the angle of the picture.
Yeah.
Taller
yeah,
than
it could be. But in Numbers 13:23 and 24... when they, and that's referring to the spies Moses sent out at God's command, when they came to the valley of Eshcol, and there cut down a branch with one cluster of grapes, they carried it between two of them on a pole. They also brought some of the pomegranates and figs. The place was called the valley of Eshcol because of the cluster which the men of Israel had cut down. So that sounds like even, you know, greater than what we're used to thinking of grapes, that they had a, you know, one cluster and two guys had to carry it. So, you know, it's very, very likely that even though Israel was very, very dependent on the rain and the weather and the climate and the cycles, that maybe the land of milk and honey was a little bit more abundant than what we see today or what we can project. We don't know. That's 3,400 years ago, so it's kind of hard to tell. And there's a barley field. Okay, so that's kind of the honey part of Israel's produce. The next is the milk, which is livestock. And we know that we got a class going on next door that all 2 months they've been talking about sheep and the role of the shepherds. And this was very big in Israel's economy. The sheep and the goats, the cattle, and they had lots of pasture land because they had a lot of land that wasn't good for growing, you know, not good Midwest soil. We've talked about certain areas where they could, but there's lots of land where there's enough that grew, at least at times, where they could pasture, they could graze. The cattle, the lambs, and everything could graze. In Genesis 46:33 and 34, when Pharaoh calls you and says, "What is your occupation?" you shall say, "Your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth even until now, both we and our fathers." Now that was true, they weren't lying, but Joseph wanted that to be made public because the Egyptians thought very lowly of shepherds and those kinds of people. So they put them off in their own little area in Goshen. So the Israelites were able to just stay together and grow as a nation away from the Egyptians. There was no temptation to intermarry because they thought them very bad. Also thought of as a means of, you know, are you rich or are you poor? Well, you got lots of cattle, you're rich. Think of Job. Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and in gold, but they mentioned livestock first. And the whole idea of the pastoral imagery, the shepherds, the grazing of livestock is used greatly in both the Testaments. The most important domesticated animals in the time of Israel were the cattle, the sheep, the goats, oxen, and donkeys. Okay. So camels are still prevalent out there. Well, they're not roaming wild anymore, but they are still there. See, that's Carla, 2009. That's at Jericho Junction. She took a ride on a camel.
That bumpier than a horse?
You'll have to ask Carla. I did not ride the cane. It's a little tricky getting on and off, though, because they got to kneel down on their front knees to let you off. I have a picture of that, too, but I didn't bring that. Shepherd with a flock in the Negev. Sheep have been an important part of the life in Israel, providing local inhabitants with wool and milk and meat. A key part in the sacrificial offerings. We need to read through, and I were going through on Wednesday nights about Leviticus and all the offerings that they were to do. Not that the Israelites always did them, but there would be times when they were just, you know, hundreds, thousands of cattle, and especially sheep, would be sacrificed. So this was something they had to keep replenishing, plus for their own eating, for the wool, for the their clothing, and so forth. And the sheep that are native to Israel, it's called the fat-tailed Awasi, and is a white with brown or black head and feet. And the tails of these sheep can weigh as much as 33 pounds for the female and 22 pounds for the males. And basically, they're similar to the humps of the camel in that they store nutrients and the water in the tail to sustain themselves during the times of scarcity. So even the sheep of that time in Israel had special ways to take care of themselves, unlike the ones if you're just at the state fair and you saw all the pretty sheep and they're all groomed and, you know, no tail or tiny little tail or whatever. These are a little different. And so there's a little closer view of the sheep. And, you know, we won't even go through the discussion, but lots and lots of verses that refer to sheep, and you all know that. Now, here's a question. We didn't really talk about the foods that, you know, God deemed as clean and unclean. Basically, the clean animals for the Israelites was they had to have cloven hooves, hoof cloven in two, and ruminate or chew their cud. So there's a whole list of those. So that would be kosher, and some Jews even go by that today. But why is it not kosher to a Jew today, or in the time of Christ, not going back to here, but the time of Christ, to eat meat and dairy together? Not Christina, not Karen, not Dawn. Anybody remember? Anybody else know? Or does anybody remember? Because Christina, I can see her smiling. She's thinking about the McDonald's we went to. You could order the hamburger and the fries or whatever here, but then you had to go over to a separate spot to get the ice cream if you wanted to. So that's how they kept it separate. But
offspring of mother's milk.
Right. And that was a verse that the Pharisees took totally out of context and said, oh, that must mean we can't have dairy and meat together. So that became a rule. Very good, Dave. You get the gold star for today. Now, this is a shepherd that we encountered in 2009 when we were there with Carla and Dawn and Kim was there. And for a few shekels, you could hold a lamb. Yeah. And this, I think I mentioned last week, this is near Michmash, but this is a well where they actually made holes here or dug out in the side here places to take the water from the well, and then you could water your sheep there. And it was still used in that day for that. So the shepherds would come by, they'd fill up the little holes or the bowls there, and then the sheep could come and drink right out of those bowls. This is Professor Todd Bolin. His last semester was spring of 07, so David was in the last group to have him, but he was quite a guy. And we got to go out with him a day because we got stranded there for an extra 6 days because of a ice storm in Newark, New Jersey. Our plane didn't make it. But anyway, so we got, and there's David right there taking notes because this is class for the kids. But as I say that, the previous slide, that shepherd, he was looking for some shekels, and he found a couple of willing. Now, what's happening is that he's buying, and he's vibrating, and it kind of freaked Kim out. But she didn't drop them. Carla thought it was pretty funny, but so that's, they actually showed that picture next door last week, I think. And then finally, just donkeys were also a big part of, we've seen in the scriptures, and was ancient Israel's, one of their beasts of burdens. They would do a lot of the carrying the women or the children or the back or the packs and so forth as they traveled. Because remember, to go anywhere, it was, you know, several days' walk.
Mary? How expensive was it there, like, for things? Like, if that shepherd's, how much would that have cost if you had our dollars? Like, would it have been $3 a little lamb, or would it have
been? Four shekels was a dollar?
Four shekels was a dollar.
Right? Ish. I think, yeah, it fluctuates, but yeah. And, you know, the price is there. If you go to the old city into the Muslim section, I mean, you could get a nice lunch for like a Jewish quarter is a little bit more expensive. Of course, you might have felt more comfortable eating in the Jewish quarters, a little cleaner. But like anywhere else, the prices, hotels weren't cheap. But we were, you know, obviously we were on a tour, a package, it's kind of a deal, so. But I would think today, like Friends of Israel, things associated with the Master's University or others, you're looking probably at about $4,000 for a 9-day trip. That's all I have. Now, we're going to do all of Jesus, the New Testament, Galilee, Nazareth, Bethlehem, all that next week. So we may have to be flying. Okay, thanks.